This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Leanne Hansen. Director Darren Aronofsky's film, Black Swan, is a new take on an old theme, a ballerina whose quest for artistic excellence drives her crazy. Alex Cohen of member station KPCC in Pasadena reports that madness and ballet have often come together in a cinematic pas de deux.
In Black Swan, Natalie Portman plays a ballerina. So obsessed with her craft, the actress says she's what's known in the dance world as a bunhead.
They are sort of reputed to live and die ballet. They won't go out on a Friday or Saturday night and drink. They're not going to eat very much. They're not going to let loose.
Portman's character Nina pleads with the New York City Ballet's artistic director for the leading role in Swan Lake, but he's not convinced she's up to the task.
Every time you dance, I see you obsessed, getting each and every move perfectly right, but I never see you lose yourself. All that discipline for what?
Just want to be perfect.
You what?
Want to be perfect.
Nina manages to be perfect enough to land the part. She's graceful and innocent, but like many other celluloid ballerinas, she's unable to tap into the darker, sensual side of dance. Meanwhile, a rival dancer in the company who can threatens to steal the role of the Swan Princess away from Nina. The pressure eventually leads to a disturbing mental breakdown, where Nina herself seems to become half woman, half swan. Throughout Black Swan, Nina literally tears away at her own skin.
I just thought it was an interesting contrast to take something as beautiful as ballet and then add horror to it.
Director Darren Aronofsky.
But then I realized it wasn't that much different than actual ballets. And if you look at the great stories of the ballet, Swan Lake, Sleeping Beauty, Romeo and Juliet, they're tragic, they're gothic, they're, you know, have horrific elements.
Though Black Swan may be the most extreme case, it's one in a long list of films to cast dark and ugly shadows on one of the most beautiful art forms.
Why do you want to dance?
Why do you want to live?
Well, I don't know exactly why, but I must.
That's my answer, too.
In 1948, The Red Shoes told the story of a ballerina named Vicky who gets her big break after appearing in Swan Lake. Film critic David Ehrenstein wrote the liner notes for the DVD re-release of The Red Shoes. He explains that Vicky's madness stems from a difficult choice.
In becoming a star, she then also falls in love with a young composer, and she is then stuck between her love for the composer and her love for the world of ballet.
In Vicky's case, the stress eventually drives her to jump in front of a train. Things work out a bit better for Shirley MacLaine and Anne Bancroft in the 1977 film The Turning Point. The two portray middle-aged ballet dancers whose lives seem incomplete. One because she left ballet to raise a family, the other seems to have nothing but an existence in pointe shoes.
You don't remember when Michael was choreographing Anna Karenina?
Yes, of course I do.
And who was he rehearsing for the part of Anna?
You and me.
And?
You got pregnant.
Yeah. And you got 19 curtain calls.
In most ballet films, that choice between dance and domesticity is just one of many elements causing emotional and physical pain. In fact, there are so many common elements in these movies, you could easily base a drinking game on them. You'd be chugging for each close-up of a blistered foot, scenes depicting endless hours of grueling rehearsals, and injuries that can end a dancer's career in an instant. There's also the overbearing stage mothers, like the one in the film Center Stage about students at a ballet academy in New York.
I don't want to be a ballet dancer.
Yes, you do. You always have.
No, Mom. If this were what I wanted, I wouldn't be as unhappy as I've been. And I'd have friends. I'd sleep well. I wouldn't throw up half the things that I eat.
You watch your weight. There's nothing wrong with that.
God, don't you hear me? I'm telling you, I'm unhappy and sick. I can't do this anymore. Don't you care about this?
Of course I care, of course, but this is your dream. Maureen, don't just throw away your dream.
Dreams of young ballerinas in film often become nightmares because of the emotional duress caused by stern instructors and demanding impresarios. In Robert Altman's The Company, actor Malcolm McDowell plays a role based on the artistic director of the Joffrey Ballet.
What happened? I mean, you're all so pretty. You know how I hate pretty. Now, come on. I mean, lift thighs. Lift up. Not so loady. You look like you've got a load in your pants.
The depiction of the teachers and the directors in the films are very grim, aren't they? They're just horrible people. And we're not.
Susan Pillar danced with the real New York City Ballet for 16 years and now teaches at the School of American Ballet. She says ballet films tend to go overboard. The dancers have a lot more fun in real life than they do on the silver screen. But she says it's easy to understand why movie directors present ballet this way.
Real ballet life is not going to make a great movie because it's not dramatic enough.
But film critic David Ehrenstein disagrees. Just look, he says, at all the sacrifice required to become a great ballerina. Most begin their training when they're just a few years old.
And your career is very short. A dancer's career only lasts as long as a dancer's body is able to do the work. That's great dramatic material.
Which is why director Darren Aronofsky chose ballet as the focus of his film, Black Swan. Originally, he says, the screenplay revolved around two actresses competing with each other off-Broadway. But he says the world of ballet provided a much better canvas for his psychological thriller. Though tutus and terror may not seem like a good combination at first glance, the director says the mix is working well with early audiences, especially since so many American moviegoers have a penchant for horror.
The thing that's been most interesting is getting these guys who come in who have no interest in ballet and dance and hear them say, oh, the ballet sequences were so beautiful. So getting that beauty next to the pain and the blood and the angst, it will hopefully give people something different to see that they've never seen before.
And Aronofsky says that thrill may just motivate moviegoers who've never seen a ballet performance in their lives to check out the real thing. For NPR News, I'm Alex Cohen.
Last week, we broadcast a story on DIY hacker spaces. Now, those are real, not virtual spaces. They're sort of communal workrooms where do-it-yourselfers can find the tools and expertise to repurpose everyday items. This week, John Kalish reports on how these facilities serve as incubators for small businesses.
You can join a hackerspace if you want to do crafts and put together electronic kits, but most are much more than that. They offer state-of-the-art machinery and like-minded people who can inspire your own creativity. Hacker spaces are an ecosystem for invention and innovation. The MakerBot is a desktop 3D printer found in virtually every hackerspace on the planet. It takes a computer file for a three-dimensional object and renders it in plastic. The MakerBot was created by three members of the Brooklyn Hackerspace NYC Resistor.
Being at a hackerspace is what led us start MakerBot.
Hacker Bree Pettis is co-founder of MakerBot.
We had tools there. We had friends there that were all the time who were resources and helpful. And we just had a space that we could go to that wasn't our living room, that wasn't our kitchen, that wasn't our closet, that was shared, that we could go and be creative at. And I just think it's so important if you're going to push the boundaries to have a place where you can do it and have support.
Pettis and his fellow hackers initially put together MakerBot kits at NYC Resistor, making parts with the hackerspace's laser cutter. But demand was so high they had to rent a manufacturing space of their own, which is known as the Bot Cave. MakerBot now has 15 employees.
We're a real force of nature now.
At the Philadelphia hackerspace Hive 76, member Chris Thompson started a business called Meat Cards. Two colleagues at his day job helped him find a new use for a laser cutter.
They were saying, oh, wouldn't it be cool to have edible business cards made of beef jerky? Chris has a laser, let's do this. And so the next day I bought some beef jerky at 7-Eleven, and I threw it in laser, and it worked. Started making samples, got a lot of Twitter followers and buzz. Sold a bunch for Christmas.
Thompson is not the only one here at Hive 76 to do small batch manufacturing on the premises. Jack Zilkin turns old manual typewriters into computer keyboards. It took Zilkin 6 months to wire up his first typewriter, which he promptly displayed on Etsy, a website devoted to handmade goods.
I basically made one prototype, and then on a lark, I put it up on Etsy. I was hoping that people would, like, comment on it on Etsy or say, like, oh, that's a cool item. But it turns out that I posted on Etsy at like maybe 1 o'clock in the morning. And then by the time I'd woken up, someone bought it. So I was like, whoa.
Zilkin can barely keep up with demand for his typewriter keyboards, which sell for as much as $700. He markets them with a photograph of an iPad sitting in a typewriter's paper tray, an idea he got from a fellow hacker. The popularity of the iPad has helped to launch another hackerspace business. 30-year-old Patrick Buckley is a San Francisco entrepreneur who joined a for-profit hackerspace in Menlo Park, California, called TechShop. It was at this sprawling, high-end hackerspace that he perfected a prototype for the Dodo case, a book-like cover for iPads.
Speed up the spindle a little bit.
Buckley used a computer-controlled milling machine known as a ShopBot to make precise cuts in a piece of bamboo plywood, but he didn't get the results he wanted. Thankfully, another TechShop member showed him how to get the software to do the job.
Without TechShop, we never would have been able to do proof of concept with Dodo Case. That first step is hugely important in any business. You need to take it from idea stage to something that you can communicate to people, put it in their hand and have them say, oh yeah, wow, I really get that, you know?
The cooperative atmosphere of hackerspaces is enabling tinkerers and entrepreneurs to let their imaginations run wild and sometimes even develop commercially viable products. Dozens of for-profit and non-profit hackerspaces are currently being planned around the country. For NPR News, I'm John Kalish in New York.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News.
Scientists still can't account for most of the 4 million barrels of oil that spewed into the Gulf of Mexico from the BP oil well. Samantha Joy from the University of Georgia says a lot of it ended up on the seafloor. In fact, she's on the seafloor right now in a research submarine along with NPR science correspondent Richard Harris. They're among the first people to dive to the bottom near the BP oil well, and they join us on the line from the sub, which is called the Alvin. Richard, where are you exactly, and what are you seeing?
Well, we are about half a mile under the surface of the sea here, and we are about 10 miles from the Macondo oil well that blew out in April. The submarine is called the Alvin, and this is it is a titanium sphere that holds three people. There are three windows about 6 inches across that we peer out, and lo and behold, when we look out the window, when we hit the bottom, at first it looks completely ordinary to me, having never seen the seafloor here before, but as we stirred up the seafloor a little bit, it became evident that there's a light brown layer covering the gray mud here pretty much everywhere we go. We still see fish and clams and crabs and stuff like that all over the place. But clearly there's also this brown tinge every direction we look in.
Can you tell us how thick that layer looks? Give us a sense of it.
The layer where we are right now isn't very thick. I would say half an inch or something, or maybe even a little bit less than that. But it's everywhere you look. So when you consider that, you know, hundreds and hundreds of square miles were under the spill on the surface, there could be a little bit right here could translate to a lot of oil in total on the seafloor.
And Richard, Samantha Joy is there with you. She's from the University of Georgia. Samantha, tell me, you've been monitoring this since shortly after the spill. What effect do you think the oil is having on marine life on the seafloor?
Well, it's surprising when you are collecting cores remotely with a multi-core. They come up and there's really no marine life in them. All the fauna that we saw in September were deceased. But now that we're in the bottom, the animals that are here, some of them don't look so healthy, but one thing that we haven't really seen a lot of is animals living in the sediment. What we see is the mobile organisms that can sort of move and get away. The organisms that can't get away, we're not seeing so much of here on the bottom.
And is there any way to tell, in fact, how widespread this layer you're seeing is on the seafloor?
Well, one of the objectives of this dive is to, we're working in about a 900 meter by 300 meter grid, and we're going to visit 8 sites along this grid and sample randomly to see just how heterogeneous distribution of oil on the seafloor is.
Richard, the federal government has been downplaying the idea that a lot of oil from the BP blowout ended up on the seafloor. Do you think samples and videos from this dive can help settle this question?
Yes, I think this dive could actually very much help answer that question. We've just turned on a UV light during the course of this conversation, and as they shine the light out on the surface is turning bright green, and Samantha Joy tells us that's a sure sign that what we're looking at here is actually oil. As you know, the federal government has attempted to calculate how much oil is out here and so on, and there's a lot that they can't account for. Actually, Samantha Joy strongly believes that a lot of what they can't find is right where we are right now.
That's NPR's Richard Harris on the submarine Alvin at the bottom of the Gulf of Mexico with researcher Samantha Joy. Thanks so much to both of you, and have fun down there.
Thanks very much, Audie. Great to talk to you.
Thanks a lot.
Dan Buettner is a researcher, explorer, and author. His 2008 book, The Blue Zones, was a New York Times bestseller. In it, Buettner tells of his travels to places that nurture longevity. Now he's researched people for a new book, Thrive, Finding Happiness the Blue Zones Way. Dan Buettner is in the studios of Minnesota Public Radio in St. Paul. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Delight to be here.
The people that you profile in this book are living in different places. They range from Denmark to Singapore to San Luis Obispo, California. So what characterizes a happy person in the happy place of Denmark?
Okay, so normally when we think of happiness, we think of money and status, but actually Denmark teaches us the opposite lesson. There you have a place where you're taxed to the mean, the marginal tax rate is 70%. A cultural norm reminds everybody that they're no better than anybody else, so you're not going to choose your career path based on status. So what you have are 4 million people who excel at things like furniture design and architecture. They work about 37 hours a week on average. They take their full 6 weeks of vacation. And they choose their job because it interests them as opposed to it's going to make them money.
Singapore is another place where you go. Now, this is a place that has a very strict set of laws. How happy are the people really if their lives are so regulated?
What you have here is a place that's very secure. Evolutionarily speaking, we're more hardwired for security than freedom. And there's also tax laws in place that encourage people to stay close to their aging parents. That way, the elderly are better taken care of and happier. And it turns out the way socialization works, we actually get more satisfaction retroactively socializing with our parents than anybody else.
You write you found the happiest people in San Luis Obispo, California. So what makes them happy?
In the 1970s, city council made a very clear decision to shift away from an environment that favored commerce and one that favored quality of life. They outlawed drive-throughs so you didn't have idling cars polluting the air. We know dependably one of the things that Americans hate on a day-to-day basis is commuting in their car. So they made bicycling easier. They were the first city in the world to outlaw smoking in bars and in restaurants. So as a result, you have the highest level of emotional well-being.
The climate in each one of these places is different. San Luis Obispo, California, I mean, you know, beautiful, temperate. Singapore, hot, sunny. Denmark, cloudy, cold. are people happy inside? Is that the deal?
Well, there's something called a sun bonus, and if you take these tens of millions of surveys and control for everything else, you do get about a 2% bump if you live in a sunny area, and you also get a bump in happiness if you live on the water. You don't, however, see that in mountains or deserts. But you have to realize happiness is a multivariable equation, and Denmark has some of the really big variables in place, like tolerance. This is a place where if you can be gay and married and you don't have to feel bad about it. You can be a minority. It's a place where people can be themselves easier, which trumps just sunny weather.
Define happiness. I mean, is it just the absence of sadness or worry, or is there more to it?
The way researchers answer happiness is through surveys that show people a ladder, and there's 10 rungs on the ladder. The lowest rung is your worst possible life, and the highest rung is your best possible life, and people place their own happiness. And when you think of it, the answer of that is enormously complex, because it encapsulizes how do you feel health-wise? How do I feel about my relationships? How do I feel about where I live?
So how does one then perhaps set up one's life to boost the chances for happiness?
I think the secret is to set up permanent nudges and defaults. For example, in our financial lives, we know that financial security has a 3 times greater impact on our happiness than just income alone. So setting up automatic savings plans and buying insurance as opposed to buying a new thing, because the newness effect of a new thing wears off in about 9 months or a year. Financial security can last a lifetime. We know that the happiest people in America socialize about 7 hours a day, which is a lot more than the average person gets, but living in a neighborhood where there are sidewalks, getting married, you're 3 times more likely to be happy if you're married, and proactively adding happy friends to your network. Each new friend will boost your own happiness by about 10%.
You also talk about picking the right job, and one of the criteria you mentioned is try to work in a place where the people you work with have a happy hour after work.
We know the biggest determinant of whether or not you'll like your job is if you have a best friend there. More so than how much you're paid, proactively making sure you have good friends there. One way I assert you can do that is be the one who organizes the happy hour.
And I was surprised to see that in all of the advice you give, you do suggest that people develop an appreciation for the arts or a sport.
Yes, when thinking about how you're going to spend your money, experiences provide much longer term happiness than buying things. The luster of an experience can actually go up with time. So learning to play a new instrument, learning a new language, those sorts of things will play dividends for years or decades to come.
Are you any happier now that you've written these 2 books on happiness?
You know, you spend most of your waking hours working, most of us do, and I have always followed exactly what interests me, and I've never really worried about the money. And when you think about it, to be able to travel the world for National Geographic on expense account and pursue exactly what interests you, it just doesn't get much better than that.
Dan Buettner is the author of Thrive, Finding Happiness, The Blue Zone's Way. He spoke to us from Minnesota Public Radio in St. Paul. Thanks a lot, Dan.
It was, shall we say, a happy experience to talk to you.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Leanne Hansen. President Obama's fiscal commission will meet this week to try to hammer out a debt reduction plan. At least 14 of the commission's 18 members need to approve the plan before it can go forward. NPR will set up the details of the meetings in a series of stories over the next couple of days. They will explore the roots of the debt, the political challenge of reducing the red ink, and what happens if Washington fails to get the country's finances under control. NPR's John Idstey and Scott Horsley reported the series, and they're in the studio. Welcome to both of you gentlemen.
Hi, Leanne.
Good to be with you.
John, I want to start with you. You found that the U.S. has not one debt problem, but several?
We do. And let's start back when we had a surplus. Back in 2000, then-President Clinton handed off an actual surplus to the new president, George W. Bush. But in the intervening decade, we had 2 wars that were not paid for, 2 tax cuts that weren't paid for, and a big prescription drug benefit that wasn't paid for. That left us with some big deficits. Now, those deficits might have been manageable, but when the financial crisis hit, we had big bailouts, President Obama's giant fiscal stimulus plan, and in the last 2 years, we've had deficits $1.4 trillion and $1.3 trillion, and this year probably another $1 trillion. So there's a really two separate things. One is this sort of profligacy of that decade and then the financial crisis. But the third source of our deficits is really out in the future. It's Social Security and Medicare as the population ages. Now, there are two big programs, but it's much easier to solve the Social Security problem. You can do it with some modest tax increases, modest benefit cuts, rise in the retirement age. Medicare is a much bigger problem. And the problem there, a large part of it, is just the rising cost of health care, getting that under control. And we really haven't figured out how to do that.
Do policymakers have to address all of these problems, or will some of them maybe take care of themselves?
Well, the deficits that occurred as a result of the financial crisis will largely go away. We've retrieved some money from the bailout programs. When people go back to work and the unemployed folks begin to make incomes again and begin to pay taxes again, then the deficit will stabilize. As far as not paying for two wars and two tax cuts and a prescription drug plan, we're going to have to deal with that. There will have to be some new revenue or cuts, probably both, to take care of that.
Scott Horsley, the country's been running in the red for a long time now. Why has this taken on a sense of urgency now?
Well, I think part of it's political. There are some people for whom concerns about the debt are really just a proxy for concerns about what they see as a more activist government. But we've also come through a financial crisis that was largely caused by families and institutions borrowing more than they safely should have. And I think people have been sort of internalized that lesson and said, well, if it's not good for a homeowner to take on too big a mortgage, then it's probably not good for the government either. And we have seen these sort of dire situations in other countries, Greece and now Ireland. So that's created some real concern out there in the public.
Do you think it's especially hard to talk about cutting spending and raising taxes when so many Americans are digging their way out of the recession?
Well, it's a little bit confusing because the sorts of things that the government needs to do to address the deficit in the long term are the opposite of the things that the government needs to do to address the recession in the short run. And so it's hard to sort of get one simple bumper sticker slogan for what you want to do. Economists have said it's certainly possible to do the things in the short run we need to do to address the recession and then make a plan for taking the steps in the longer term to address the deficit and the debt. And in fact, none of the commissions that have been making these recommendations are suggesting we do something right away. The earliest medicine that they're suggesting is maybe 2012.
What happens if this isn't solved?
Well, we've been hearing some pretty dire warnings about what could happen. At some point, the folks who are lending us money, the countries that are lending us money, might get tired of that, and they might impose some pretty draconian conditions if they're going to continue to bail us out. Just as a creditor will sometimes impose tough conditions on a company that gets too deep in debt, we could find ourselves having to answer to the International Monetary Fund. They could say, okay, we're going to come to your rescue, United States, but you didn't get your house in order yourselves. We're going to now tell you how to do it. We're going to say you have to reduce your defense budget. You're going to have to get your entitlement programs like Social Security under control. I think what these commissions are doing is saying, let's try to take the actions we need to take on our own terms now rather than have them imposed on us from the outside.
So what happens if they're actually able to solve the problem?
Well, I hadn't thought about that.
That's actually the happy ending. And we saw this sort of virtuous cycle in the 1990s when we did, for a brief period, get our budget under control. And what happens is interest rates come down, companies are able to borrow more money, the government has more money left over to make productive investments. While there is certainly some pain and sacrifice associated with fixing this problem, there are some real benefits for the country in coming out the other side.
NPR's Scott Horsley and NPR's John Idsty. Thank you both, gentlemen.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
To take a cue from Dan Buettner, listening to music is a step toward happiness, and many songs have been written to try to make you happy. These days are all. Ah, yes, Happy Days, unabashed nostalgia for the 50s, heard on television in the 1970s, a decade that also spawned the Partridge Family's iconic theme. Traveling along, there's a song that we're singing. Come on, get happy. Then there are the subtle songs, the ones that work their way into your happy place without explanation, without regard to lyrics or genre. Earlier this month, the Fox show Glee featured a cast rendition of Katy Perry's Teenage Dream. The Glee cover soared into the Billboard Top 10, and the video performance scored more than 3.5 million views on YouTube. You'll hear why. On Twitter, we asked for your happy songs. Selections ranged from 80s cheese to soul classics. The Safety Dance by Men Without Hats does it for user SG Spires 68. User Roz Algethi can count on Stevie Wonder's Sir Duke to make her happy every time. As for me, well, it's an oldie but a goodie. The Turtles, a.k.a. Flo and Eddie, singing Happy Together.
So happy together.
Okay, so what music makes you happy? Let us know on Twitter. We are at NPR Weekend.
Me and you, you and me. No matter how they toss the dice, it had to be. The only one for me is you, and you for me. So happy together.
This is NPR's Weekend Edition, directed by Ned Wharton and produced by Elaine Heinzman, Gemma Waters, Kimberly Adams, Claudette Lindsay Haberman, Jess Gittner, and Chris Benderev. Our technical director is Burke Hahn, the librarian is Kim Leski, Melissa Goh is our web producer. Our show was produced today by Sarah Beyer-Kelly and edited by Deborah George and Louise Clemens. Our senior editor is Jenny Bergall, and the senior producer of Weekend Edition is Bridget Kelly. All together now, I'm Leanne Hansen.